Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we have an assortment of interviews.
Yeah, an assortment. There you go.
Yeah. Starting out with my good buddy, Chris Rangiatis, who opened a restaurant, was it a year ago or a little over a year ago?
Well, we're staying local. To begin with, we're in Pittsburgh.
Okay. And anyhow, the restaurant is called Spork, which is that odd a combination
of a spoon and a fork.
But what we're really talking about is this spiffy new oven. He got a Swedish oven that's a knockout. And the pizza is fabulous.
And then you'll have to stay with us, and then you'll find out where we're going next.
Christian Frangiata certainly knows his way around the restaurant industry, don't you, Chris?
Well, a little bit.
Yeah, we've been friends for many a year, and you took off and left us here for a while, and you hung around on islands and got married, had a kid, and moved back. And so here you are now back in Pittsburgh with a smash hit. Spork is your restaurant. Tell us, first of all, what a spork is.
So a spork is a cross between a spoon and a fork. So it's a spoon with tines.
Uh-huh.
And we just, seriously felt that the spork was underrepresented in the world of flatware, and we wanted to elevate it to its rightful place.
And you wanted to have fun with your restaurant theme.
Yeah, we didn't want to be too serious.
We were
serious about the food, serious about the service, the ambiance, but we wanted to also not be too serious about everything.
Now, there was another implement similar to a spork called a splayed. I don't know if you ever came across that. They made an entry into the market in England when I was a child, I should think, which means it was a very long time ago.
Well, I'm fully aware of the splayed, that might be our spin-off restaurant.
There we go. Okay. Why not?
Not really.
Some woman is suing a restaurant for serving a spork, by the way. Did you know that?
Oh, well, I guess we better be careful. Good thing we have an attorney on retainer.
Yep. Anyhow, tell us about, first of all, you're in Garfield, which is a up-and-coming area of the city, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's being revitalized at a rate that's really quite shocking. In the 7 months that we've been open, it's really just grown in leaps and bounds. It's pretty impressive.
Well, your timing was exquisite, because the rest of the merchants down Penn Avenue were absolutely dying because the street was closed for such a long time. So your timing was extraordinarily good.
Yeah, I think it was closed pretty much the whole time I was in the Virgin Islands. It was down for a long time. Yeah,
but for Pittsburghers who stayed away from Garfield, because first of all, they thought Penn Avenue was still closed, and secondly, it wasn't necessarily a neighborhood they wanted to go to, they'll find a whole new Penn Avenue with lots and lots of interesting merchants, restaurants, art supplies, just a wide variety of things. And your location is, you're like a short block away from the children's home, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and then there certainly is a lot of activity. Seems like there's new merchants popping up every month.
Now, tell us what the concept is of your restaurant, and also about the design, which is gorgeous.
Okay, so the concept basically is it's kind of an approachable dining, casual, but hopefully with a pretty cool vibe. We specialize in pastas, pastries, ice cream, charcuterie, breads, and all of them are prepared from scratch in-house. We have our own curing chamber, and pretty much our motto is no products.
Yeah, I don't understand how you can do all this stuff. You make your own pickles, your own bread.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
When do you have time to do all that?
There's a few of us that are, we like to think that we're a bit dedicated, and we try and work fast, and that's it.
Now you just added a new tool to your repertoire, which is extraordinary and unusual in Pittsburgh. Tell us about the great... Is it a bread oven? I'm not sure.
It's a pizza oven.
It's a three-deck oven that we actually imported from Sweden. We make a lot of bread in the restaurant, and we do kind of long fermented baguettes, and we're really, you know, looking for the best way to put something like that out. We came across this steam injected oven from Sweden, and
that's what it is, a steam injected oven, huh?
Yeah, and that, you know, that helps you get sort of like that nice crust on the outside,
right,
while retaining, you know, the moisture and softness on the inside. So, you know, we were interested in bringing a better oven in to do bread. We also have a love for kind of Neapolitan style pizza. Traditionally, that's always done in, you know, about 900 degrees with the wood burning oven. And technically, it can't really be called Neapolitan pizza unless it's from a wood burning oven, but this is the closest thing. So the third deck of our oven actually goes up to 932 degrees, and it's specifically for pizza.
So, but you're not burning wood. You're using gas as your fuel?
It's actually electric.
It's
my belief that it's the only electric oven capable of going to 932 degrees in the world.
Well, how did you find it? I mean, I would never look at Sweden for any kind of a bread or pizza oven.
No, but we figured, you know, just like the Volvo, it would be safe. But we found it in the restaurant in the trade show in Chicago. So it's a company called Pizza Masters, and they had a booth set up in Chicago. We were down there looking, came across the oven. We were always interested in trying to incorporate Neapolitan pizzas into our concept, or Neapolitan-style pizzas into our concept. We lucked out and found something where we could kill two birds with one stone and kind of improve our bread service and add the Neapolitan-style pizzas into the mix.
Now, you're going after a certain market. Explain what you're doing with your late-night dining and so forth.
Yeah, so typically, you know, since we opened, which was about 8 months ago now, Sport's only been open for dinner. So typically, you know, we open 5 to 10, 5 to 11 on weekends, do only dinner service. We think that there's a niche with the revitalization of the Penn Avenue corridor and a lot of the service industry being kind of in the general area. There's a lot of service industry people in Lawrenceville, a lot of service industry people in East Liberty. A lot of these people get off work and they don't really have any place to go. Isn't basically beer and darts.
Yeah.
So we thought that there's a niche there to serve those people and frankly anybody else in the pretty bustling area at this point, late night. So the pizzas, so basically we can't do the whole menu until 2 o'clock in the morning. So we decided to center it around pizzas, bread, jars, mason jars, pickled vegetables, savory spreads, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that all is quite good too. I mean, your charcuterie is splendid.
Yeah, so we want to showcase that as well and give, you know, people maybe a little bit more of a sophisticated option, but still at a price that's not going to break the bank.
Now, Chris, you said that your designer, who is your designer?
Yeah. Her name is Julie Strike. Actually, she just got married, so now it's Julie Duncan. I don't think it's hyphenated.
Okay.
But anyway, she's pretty amazing. She's Harvard-educated. I think she runs an orphanage over in Africa. She's a life coach, and she does design on the side, and she's just one of those really creative people.
That's a beautiful
that
space.
She has a great design sense, and she sort of teamed up with the folks down at the tech shop in Bakery Square, and we kind of had everything fabricated for the restaurant here locally, and a lot of repurposed wood
and barn wood tables. Now, you said she's making some modifications to accommodate the late night. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, because the restaurant, which I think has a really nice vibe.
Oh, yeah.
We think to go late night, you have to be able to tweak it and sort of transition a little bit so that it's maybe a little bit more of a lounge atmosphere and not so much of a restaurant atmosphere. At the same point, we didn't want to change the restaurant vibe during the hours that we're open for dinner. So Julie came in and kind of came up with some creative lighting solutions that would give it maybe a little bit more of a bar vibe later at night.
Huh, great. Now, I mean, I love all this, but, you know, my favorite thing you make, besides the charcuterie, which I've always loved, is that duck. What do you do to that duck?
Well, I think we just, you know, the breath, we render it really well so that the skin's crispy. We sous vide it until it's about medium rare. We serve it with a foie gras emulsion. So it's sort of like a veal stock reduction that's got foie gras.
Oh, really? No wonder.
Into it.
No wonder my home duck is not the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's not tricky, but we like to think that it's executed well.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. Yeah. So, and we should add, you don't take reservations.
No.
You do have a website, which is
sportpittsburgh.com.
And Pittsburgh's PGH, right?
Yes.
Yes, sportpittsburgh.com. And, and are you closed any nights or days?
We are closed on Sundays.
Sundays.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you well with your adventure. And, and we love coming there. It's such a nice, you have a good team going, too.
Yeah, we have some really neat people who've kind of come from all over the United States to work with us, and it's been a lot of fun. We are open Thursday, Friday, and Saturday is the nights where we'll be open till 2 a.m.
Okay.
And we're actually running a reverse happy hour also from 10 to 12 on those days.
Now, that's a good thing.
So cocktails, beers, things like that will be discounted as well from 10 to 12.
Oh, great. Well,
Night owls like us will be right over there.
Yes, perfect.
I think our next dinner schedule is 5:30.
you know us well enough to know we're joking. we don't exactly stay up late.
That's okay. We need people at all hours. We're open.
Yeah, well, I'm loving having you back in town and enjoy your restaurant, and I wish you luck with this new venture. And I'm very envious of this good-looking oven.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's great to be back here. It's certainly an exciting time at Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Christian Frangiotis, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, it's an odd thing for me to say, but I'm very proud of this next guest, Leah Lizarondo, who started an organization called 412, which is the area code of Pittsburgh, 412 Food Rescue. I have no reason to be proud of it, except that it's exactly what we need exactly right now, and that it could be successful in our little corner of the world. Has to be really just thrilled and anxious to support her.
And it's a tribute to the energy
of
this young lady who invented the idea.
And she is energetic for sure.
And then made it happen. And it's only going to get bigger and more important as time goes by. And it's going to be copied all over the place, we feel sure. So if it's not happening yet in your neck of the woods, expect that it might be sometime soon, and if there's something you can do to make that happen, well, you ought to be inspired by this conversation.
Leah Lizarondo, we're going to be talking today about your project of 412 Food Rescue, which you founded and you run. I was trying to get some background on you, and you've done a lot of every kind of thing. You were born and raised in the Philippines. You came to New York. You worked for a tech company. You came to Pittsburgh, and you studied public policy, and you got a graduate degree in public policy at CMU. How does all this – I'm trying to get my head around all of this. Can you give me a shortcut?
A shortcut. Yeah, the shortcut is, you know, through all my work life, you know, I was doing something else, but really my passion has always been food. And I still remember the very first amazing present that my father gave me. And I don't know if you guys remember this set of books from Time Life. It was called Foods of the World.
Uh-huh.
And it was this kind of encyclopedic collection of each country.
I still have some.
Yes, we had the complete collection of that, and I was a child, and I remember that's how I first, you know, quote unquote, traveled the world. I would, you know, me and my brother would voraciously read through them, and, you know, the first recipe I ever made in my life was a recipe from the Swedish cookbook from that collection. It was Swedish meatballs. And I just loved food, but never really thought of it as, you know, something that was viable as a career. And so, you know, I went to technology and business, which I also, you know, love, but truly, like, the overarching, my passion is food. And about 5 years ago, when I was, you know, in Pittsburgh again, I saw kind of the impending change in the food world here, and I was really interested in being part of that. And so, you know, like many people now, and even 5 years ago, I decided to start a blog, not really thinking anything about it. You know, I thought thinking it would be a hobby. But, you know, Pittsburgh Magazine picked it up, and I started writing a weekly column, and the focus was on healthy food, but by default, because it was the only real, you know, food column in Pittsburgh Magazine that was online and was churning out every week, I was able to cover a lot more than that and actually became, you know, part of the growing food culture in Pittsburgh, and that was really fun.
Yeah, your blog is called The Brazen Kitchen, right?
Correct, yeah, and it went on to win a national award, the CRMA award, which was really surprising to me because I'm not a trained writer at all.
Well, but you write very well. I mean, it doesn't all come down to training, does it? But when did you become interested in being an activist for food waste and food deserts and food shortages and needs?
Yeah.
I mean, when did that hit you? Was that part of the original Brazen Kitchen?
Yeah, that was part of the Brazen Kitchen. I was talking about health and food access and, you know, how we could, you know, think of food as both pleasurable and, you know, really benefiting us nutritionally. And throughout my writing, you know, I just became more and more aware of the disconnect between, you know, the people who can have a choice in terms of accessing healthy food and people who don't even have, you know, access to any food. And the more I became aware of that, the more I wanted to do something about it, you know, became really passionate about nutrition education and making sure everyone has access to it. And one day when I was hanging out with my friend Giselle Fetterman at her free store Braddock. She was getting, she had to leave because she had to get some food from Costco that was about to get thrown out.
Oh.
And so I said, well, how often does this happen? And she said, well, it happens at least 3 times a week when we're open. I always pick up food so we can have free food here at the free store. And so that was the beginning of this idea. And I asked her, you know, let's work together on this and let's launch this, and kind of taking a cue from the work that her relationship with Costco, you know, I said, what if we build an organization that builds all these relationships with all these grocery stores? And that's when 412 Food Rescue was born. And since then, you know, 412 Food Rescue has forged a really important partnership with Giant Eagle. And Giant Eagle is one of our most, is one of our biggest donors.
And 412 is the area code for Pittsburgh.
Correct, yes.
And Giselle is the wife of the mayor of Braddock, and the Free Store is a marvelous project where people donate all these things, and people who need them go and get them for nothing.
For nothing, yes. And that's the same model we have with 412 Food Rescue is, you know, we get this food donated and we give it away for free. You know,
how do you do that? What is the mechanism that whereby people can, I mean, are you involved with SNAP or what, how does it work?
So we have partnerships, as I said, with food retailers, including Giant Eagle and Paragon Foods, and we also work with the East End Food Co-op. So we have about 150 retail partners currently, and that includes restaurants and caterers. And what we do is we have agreements with them, and basically they agree that if they have surplus food, we can take it. And And then on the other side of that is we have partnerships with about 200 nonprofits that serve those who are food insecure.
Okay.
So anywhere from housing projects to soup kitchens and Meals on Wheels programs. And what we do is we match the available food with the appropriate nonprofits. And then our volunteers, you know, take it from one location to the other, much like an Uber driver takes a passenger.
Uh-huh. That's amazing. And so, but there's, I mean, do you have, you probably have numbers on all of this.
Yeah.
Like now, what is like the quantity of food that you get donated on, say, what's an easy number for you, a month, a week, what?
Yeah. So we were founded in March 2015, so we are about 18 months old, and in the last 18 months, we've recovered about 800,000 pounds of food. So this year, we will have recovered a million pounds, yes.
And was it, I mean, when you say this was surplus, I mean, do you mean that it's like expiration date or about to expire, or what does that mean?
So surplus food can mean many different things. So one of the, there's one category is food that's approaching its sell-by date,
right,
not necessarily its expiration date, because those are two different dates. And so, you know, when food is approaching its sell-by date, typically retailers take it off the shelf because consumers look at it and they, when they see that it's about to, you know, to approach a sell-by date tomorrow, they won't buy it. So we get those food, and then we redistribute them. The other thing is, you know, rejected produce.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one, isn't it?
That's a big one. And these are produce that, you know, may have some slight imperfections that, you know, may not even be obvious to regular consumers, but for some reason does not pass the standards of a retailer. And so we get those. And redistribute them. And some foods, it's just, you know, food that might be unsellable because it's not, retailers are not able to hold it on the shelf, you know, such as yellow bananas. Consumers like buying green bananas and letting it ripen at home. If a banana bunch is yellow, it gets left behind because, you know, it will be too ripe in a couple of days.
Uh-huh.
So we're able to recover those and distribute them on the same day, even though they're not overripe today and they, you know, perfectly fine. In a couple of days they will be, but we're able to pass them on to people who can use them that same day. So those are the...
It works that fast, huh?
It does. So we are a direct transfer organization, meaning we don't have any warehouses. All the food that we recover goes to people who can use them that same day.
I'll be darned. And yes, it's all volunteers, huh?
It's all volunteers. We have about 900 volunteers who have, you know, raised their hands and said, I want to transport food. So we have a large network of volunteer drivers. We call them food rescue heroes.
And that's good.
Yeah, and it's, they're just all over Allegheny County driving from grocery store to nonprofit.
That's amazing. Now, who was it? Was it the founder of Trader Joe's who started another supermarket chain or market chain for imperfect produce and so forth as a commercial venture?
Yes, correct. So Doug Rao is his name, and he started a in a town a little bit outside of Boston, this grocery store. He used to be the CEO of Trader Joe's, and this grocery store just resells food that, you know, have, you know, are basically surplus food, and then he sells it for a very small fraction of the retail price. And he also has a cafe that makes food out of, you know, again, food that's about to go to waste. And so he recovers a lot of that and passes on, you know, and is able to give access to really good food to consumers for a very, very low price.
I mean, there's so many different angles to approach this problem from. I mean, you obviously know Michelle, who does the SNAP.
Yes.
And that's, what is it, double food stamps. This is
yep.
Michelle Nishon, a chef
yeah.
who is now an activist, food activist, who runs the Wholesome Wave program.
Correct. Yeah.
Then you have the what was the other one I was thinking of? Massimo Bottura does, he collects all these, leftovers from all these and has star chefs make them into fabulous meals.
Mm-hmm.
He fed all the homeless people in Rio for the Olympics.
Yes, right, right.
And he's opening a shop in somewhere else, New York State. I don't know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people doing fundraisers, such as Jamilka Borges did a fundraiser for your organization.
Yes.
Which was successful. So people are coming at this. D.C. has a program, too, that's very successful. So does New York and Meals on Wheels and so forth. But how much of a dent are we making into this problem? It just seems to be so enormous. And that's, we're just talking the United States at this point, huh?
Yeah, it is so enormous. It's, you know, it's half the food supply. 40% of food, you know, goes to waste, which is just mind-boggling, that number. So there's a lot of work to be done. This has been a problem that has existed for so long. You know, the first organization that really tackled this head-on is City Harvest in New York City.
Right, exactly.
And they are fantastic. They've been around for 20 years, but it's only been in the last 3 years, really, where this movement of food recovery has grown all over the U.S. and really all over the world.
Well, you know, I go to the Fancy Food Show in New York every year. And, or covered at least. And, there's lots of fancy food, Specialty Food Association. And the, volunteers collect, for Just Harvest, all the leftovers from that. And I keep wondering how really hungry people are going to deal with truffle shavings.
Yeah. You know? Right. So, yeah, that's why it's important what Massimo Vittorio does is, you know, he actually takes all this food and cooks it and transforms it into something that is already, you know, easily edible, right? The people don't have to figure out how to put them all together. And I think that's the next step that we're going toward. And actually I'm working with Jamilka Borges and Brian Bukarczyk on crafting a plan for that. And you'll see probably an announcement of that in the next few weeks or so.
I mean, how would that work? You mean collecting from restaurants?
Yes. So, you know, a restaurant program that would take all the food that's, you know, kind of mismatched from each restaurant and making sure that you could put it together into something that makes sense and is easily distributable to those who need it.
That's a big project, too.
Mm-hmm. But it's exciting and it's new and it's just been, you know, it needs to be done.
Well, Jamilka mentioned something about a kitchen that you established.
Yeah, so we are raising funds right now for a commissary kitchen so that we can actually have a place to process food that is not as easily, like I said, redistributed.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, it's ongoing, I must say. And are you doing the blog and this full-time then?
Yes, so I'm working on 412 full time. My column in Pittsburgh Magazine, I sunsetted that last year as I was ramping up 412.
Yeah, I remember that when you decided. Now I understand.
Yeah, because it needs a lot of focus right now. So, and you know, I am gearing up to go back to writing a little bit more again, and talking about, and taking on some new projects that are also in the back burner that's going to be exciting that I can't wait to share with you hopefully next year.
Promise you'll share it?
Yes, and you'll love it. I just know it.
A really exciting project. Now I'm good. When do I get to know about it?
Still working on firming some details up, but when that's up, of course, Anne, you'll be one of the first to know.
Thank you. Let's give our listeners an opportunity to contribute something into this. How to find out what they could do to help and who to contact and any logistics or particulars about that.
Okay. Well, the easiest during this holiday season is that we have two fundraisers ongoing. One is in collaboration with East End Brewing, where we're creating a limited edition beer made from wasted bread.
Oh, great. That's a hot new thing. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's called Loaf. We call it Loaf, and it's community-supported beer, so we're releasing shares of it right now, and they can buy shares of that at 412foodrescue.org. And in December, we are releasing a collaboration liquor with Wiggle Whiskey. It is made from foraged apples from the city, and it's a kind of Pittsburgh version of a Pommeau, which is a French apple liqueur.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's a mix. It's kind of a mix of apple brandy and cider. So it's a nice kind of celebratory drink for the holidays.
Oh, that's great. And the Wiggle, they're nice people. They're good people.
Yes. So we're excited about these two fundraisers.
You must be on a constant research for volunteers too. Can people go to the same place?
Yes. So people can sign up on our page to volunteer. And you know, I think the best way to get to know what we do is to give us about half an hour of your time and go on a food rescue.
Oh, that would be fun too.
Now the other thing too is letting people who have the food know that there's something they can do with it besides throwing it away. So can they come to the same place?
So we currently work only with restaurants and retailers. We can't work with individuals yet.
Oh, sure. No, I understand.
Yeah, but they can, you know, frequent our retailers that work with us. So they know that they are socially conscious retailers.
Is there a place also, because, you know, this program is internet-based, and therefore there'll be people out of the 412 area code listening. Is there some sort of, not a manual, but some way of getting an idea of how to start one of these in your community?
If you want to start a food rescue organization in your community, we would love to help you out. And you can reach me at Leah, L-E-A-H, at 412foodrescue.org, or you can call me at 412-329-8889, and we can talk about how we can get you going.
That's wonderful, Leah. Well, you really do such a lot, and I'm so impressed with the quality of your work and your devotion and passion to it all, and yeah, you have, I'm sure, what Sonia Finn involved in this too, huh?
Yes.
The other prong of this is the sustainable kitchens. In fact, I just had a program called Zero Waste in the Chef's Kitchens at the International Chefs Collaborative or Conference. Anyhow, so there are all these different aspects of coming at it. Well, mm-hmm. Keep up the good work and keep me posted. And it's great to get to know you and to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Okay, Leah.
Okay, thank you so much. And I'll be in touch with new developments.
And after the break, which is upcoming, we're going to change the subject. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're switching our gear right here.
All together.
We have in the past brought you items from a series called Savor the South, and it focuses on individual ingredients. Well, there's a new one which has the similar focus of ingredients, except it's called the Goodness of series. And I can't remember if we've had any others, but today we're going to do the Goodness of Avocado with Lucy Jessup and the Goodness of Garlic, well, that is certainly good, by Natasha Edwards, who is actually English, isn't she?
I think so.
Yeah. I don't know. The
English,
your
English, English.
I never yeah. used garlic.
Yeah, the English, English, English. Yeah, best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all the rest.
Anyhow.
Sorry about that. Anyway, okay.
Let's talk to Lucy Jessup and the goodness of avocado. From the new series of books, cookbooks called The Goodness of, and in this case it's avocado, we have Lucy Jessup, who wrote about this wonderful fruit, 40 delicious health-boosting recipes. And Lucy, it is healthy, is it not?
It is extremely healthy, yes. Avocados are in fat, but it's the good kind of fat, monounsaturated fat rather than unsaturated fat. And it's very good for you because it can help lower cholesterol. And it also helps with the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins. So that's one of its good points. Avocados are also rich in vitamin E, which, of course, is a powerful antioxidant, very important for keeping the skin, eyes, and immune system healthy. It's also rich in potassium, which is a very important mineral and can help lower blood pressure. Bananas are often cited as a very good source of potassium, but actually avocados contain more potassium than bananas.
Now we want to make a little correction to what you say in your book when you write about where avocados can be grown.
Yes. Have I made a mistake?
This
there?
Is supposed it's kind of obscure. So you have to be forgiven. But my cousin Richard, who lives in Tasmania in Australia, is a producer of avocados,
organic avocados.
Yeah, on a north facing slope in the island state of Tasmania, and he's been doing this for about 15 years.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, and I didn't mention Australia.
No, you didn't.
Well, he's the only one. I mean, he has a captive audience, and he can sell everyone he grows.
Yeah.
And they're quite fine avocados. And
that actually leads me to the next observation I was going to make, which is that because avocados are not growing anywhere in Europe, I don't think.
Maybe Spain.
I was going to say Spain.
Although, based on Richard's example, you could certainly do that. But you'd certainly have to pick your spot. But that does make them rather expensive. And yet they've really caught on big time in England.
Yeah, they have to travel very far, don't they, to get to us, which is one of the cons, and it does make them very expensive, but everybody absolutely adores them over here. And
have we ever had them there?
Yeah, well, we haven't exactly. The last time we were there, we have relatives in London, and when we come, we get together with them for brunch or breakfast or lunch or something like that. And we were staying at the Berners Hotel.
Oh, right.
And they all came in for breakfast, and two out of the six people around the table ordered avocado toast.
Yes.
I know. It's just one of the yummiest things. It's so simple, yet it's, so delicious and good for you and filling and all the rest of it. So
I had a laugh, though, when you were talking about how to prepare an avocado. I mean, I never found it very difficult getting the seed out of an avocado. it seems right, very simple to me. But some manufacturer produced an avocado pitter and sent it to us. And
it was really funny. It was when we were still doing On the Menu Radio at the radio station.
Right.
Yes.
So I had these avocados.
Yeah, we took the ripe avocados and the avocado pitter into the studio.
Because I had not been able to figure out when you use this device that they sent, it took away like half of the avocado.
If you remember, what we did was we didn't realize how you were supposed to use it. So we put this cutter on the end of a whole avocado.
And sliced it down.
Skin and all, and pushed really hard, as only a guy can do, and the center core of the avocado shot out of the other end.
Well,
and hit the wall of the studio.
And the woman said, well, you know, I mean, it didn't have any instructions with it when it came. And the woman said, well, certainly you've cut the avocado in half, haven't you? And I said, nobody, it obviously had been translated from Chinese or something.
That was not mentioned. So
by the time you cut it in half, I mean, I would think that there's no real problem with removing the pit.
I know, but I mean, it does seem to be gadgets for everything these days, aren't necessarily needed.
It's kind of a silly gadget, because it wasn't even explained.
Now, how you organize this is interesting. Hold on a second.
Since I already gave the secret away, my cousin Richard reprimanded me for giving his major secret away, but you probably know this, but if
why
not,
are you going to tell people?
Because I've already done it, so everybody else is entitled to know.
Maybe they
If you wrote a book about avocados, you certainly need to know that. And the question is, how do you tell if an avocado is ripe?
Right. Oh, gosh. Well,
And the answer is...
Yeah?
That when they're ripe, they float.
Oh. Wow, I didn't know that.
The specific gravity of the contents of the avocado changes as it ripens. I mean, this is a scientific basis for it. And as that happens, it gets lighter. So as a result, it floats.
Well, but you have to know, without floating it in water, you have to know how to pick it off the tree or when to pick it off the tree.
Well, I think Richard relied on his sharp eye and years of experience. and probably squeezing a little bit, too.
Yeah.
But apparently...
And I guess that doesn't help when you're in the shop trying to buy one.
Well, most shops cheat. Most shops use an artificial environment with artificial ethylene to encourage the process and make it predictable.
And when they're hard as a rock, they tell you to put it in a brown paper bag to ripen.
Yeah.
But if you have a guest for dinner and you want to do
it, which she says in the book, and you can make it go faster. And I didn't realize this is very clever. No, you put a banana in with the avocados.
Absolutely.
Because bananas ripen exactly the same way.
Well, you don't have to put a banana with the avocado.
Well, it's even quicker, I think, isn't it?
I think it just speeds up the process.
Speeds it up more than just gassing them.
Well, you have now, and you've divided this book, I thought, very cleverly in the preparation of the avocado. So you have your introduction, then you have blended, smashed, chopped, sweet.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And then your recipes are in each of these things. And, some of them are, it's hard, the difference between chopped and smashed, really.
Yeah. I mean, the avocado is just so versatile. It seems like the most sensible way to split them up, just because you can use them in so many different ways. So it seemed the most kind of commonsensical way to split up the recipes. But I think guacamole, you know, that's what everybody knows and what everyone loves, and yet there are so many different ways you can vary it to make it delicious as well. There's so many different variations.
Well, what I do now is I stole the recipe from a New York City chef, and I do your basic onion, tomato, avocado, and then I put in, pistachio nuts, chili, and pistachio oil, and it's heavenly.
Yeah, that sounds really nice.
A little chili and cilantro, of course.
Well, we stole it does sound delicious.
It is good. Everybody always wants the recipe.
Yeah, the restaurant's called Empoleon. We hope they're not listening.
Empoleon. But Peter and I were most taken about the idea of using the batter fried avocado slices as soldiers with boiled eggs. I love that.
Yeah, that was actually one of the most surprising recipes of the book, and it is one of the favorites out of lots of my friends who've cooked recipes from the book. They absolutely love those because the avocado doesn't go slimy at all when you cook it. It just goes a lovely buttery kind of texture inside, and of course panko breadcrumbs and parmesan and a little bit of paprika is such a good combination and makes a really yummy, crispy coating. So, and they just work really well with a runny boiled egg. It seems like a nice twist on a Sunday brunch.
Now, you have pistachio and avocado ice cream, so you like the pistachio with the avocado.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really a delicious combination, and it's got a little bit of coconut in there as well, so it makes it dairy-free and also gives it that kind of richness and sweetness without it being too unhealthy. It's obviously still an ice cream, but it's much better for you, I think, than the dairy alternatives.
Now, you have some smoothie-type things,
too. Before we leave dessert avocados. In my great youth, I mean, I was like 21, I was having a fancy dinner party, and I tackled an avocado dessert that I found in the gourmet magazine cookbooks. And it was so awful that people just left their spoons in the bowl and it solidified.
Oh, no.
Nobody ate it. It was solidified with the spoon still sticking upright in the bowl. So I prefer the savory preparations.
I was of your view as well. And obviously with writing the book, I had to kind of open my mind, and I was a little bit cynical to begin with about using it in sweet recipes, but I promise you, only included ones which are delicious, because I wanted to make sure that they all would substitute very well for other desserts. So I'm really happy with the sweet recipes, actually. My favorites, I think, are the ice cream is one, but I also love the brownies and the banana bread. It works in baking. And you replace butter with avocado, and you honestly couldn't tell that there is no butter in the banana bread or the brownies. They taste just the same, and they're really yummy, and it reduces the saturated fat content, so it's brilliant.
Great.
I mean, they're still a treat, because they still contain sugar, and, you know, but they are really, really yummy.
Now, is this true that we're facing a potential shortage of avos?
I have heard that, which is, I think, just because of the rising demand. I'm not sure that they can keep up with it. Is it also an environmental thing?
I'm trying to remember
shortages?
We had avos, and there was coffee, was it? And they all had some kind of a biological enemy.
I don't know. From my cousin's experience, we certainly know that avocados are very finicky.
Finicky.
There's a good old English word for you. They like lots of water, but they don't like their roots to be standing in water.
Right.
So they need a lot of water, but they need to be well drained at the same time. It may be that drought effect in places. I mean, I'm sure in California, where they must grow avocados somewhere in California.
There's been a drought in Mexico too.
Yeah, so it's probably the same, and they're the two largest sources, especially Mexico in the export market.
Yeah, I imagine that they have good kind of, you know, irrigation and all the kind of proper systems in California. And Mexico, where they, you know, where they're from. But I don't know if there's any problem with disease. Perhaps, you know, there's been a disease.
Well, I know that this is true of the common banana that we all like. And it's also true of the coffee plants. And that will affect the cacao plants as well. So there's a chocolate shortage looming. Oh, I hate all these shortages.
What are those yummy-looking shots there?
Green gazpacho shots.
Yes. Yeah, they're really nice. They're lovely for summer, because you can eat it cold. And, they're really delicious, actually. I really like that recipe.
And they are really green.
Very green.
If you don't like to eat things that are green, don't make some of these recipes.
This is true. But it just tastes very refreshing. And funnily enough, I've until recently never been a huge fan of gazpacho, and I've tried lots of different ones when I was researching the avocado version, and I'm really pleased with how this one's turned out. It's very refreshing, and you do want to have it on a hot day, as you do with all gazpacho and cold soups. But it is, it's lovely, kind of refreshing soup. Well, but back to the green things and the smoothies. I really liked adding avocado to smoothie because I always thought, oh, I couldn't possibly drink a kind of vegetable tasting smoothie, but you can't taste it at all in the berry smoothie. It just adds this lovely velvety, kind of luxurious, indulgent texture to all of them. And it's almost like an avocado was invented for the use in a smoothie.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
It really does give it a lovely smooth texture.
Yeah, the texture is the greatest thing about the avocado, actually.
Well, Lucy, we hope you show up with another book in this series, because that'll give us an excuse to talk to you again soon.
That would be great. I'd love to.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll keep in touch. Maybe we'll see you next time we're in London.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, it's been really enjoyable talking to you both.
Thank you, and you too.
Thank you very much.
Bye, Lucy.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
There seems to be a new series on the goodness of and single ingredients. I don't know much about the series, but I'm going to find out. But right now, what I'm going to be doing is talking to Natasha Edwards, who wrote the book on garlic. And apparently, the recipes are, because of the garlic, they're immune-boosting recipes. Everybody knows garlic is not only tasty, but it's good for you. And Natasha, you've already told me so much. First of all, that you manage the garlic farm on the Isle of Wight, which is in the English Channel. And I never knew that garlic was a key product of the Isle of Wight. In fact, I've never been on the Isle of Wight, which I hope to remedy at some point.
We'd love to have you here.
Yeah, we have a nephew who lives in Southampton, so he's not very far away.
No, just across the water.
And I have been on the Isle of Wight, although it was at least 60 years ago. That's kind of scary to think about that, isn't it?
Which isle was it that featured in that potato peel pie?
That was Guernsey.
Guernsey. Okay.
That's Guernsey's almost in France.
And then where? Yeah.
The Isle of Wight is almost in England.
Okay, and where do my potatoes come from?
Jersey. Which is one of the Channel Islands, which is the one near Guernsey off the coast of France.
Okay.
So,
all right.
They're a long way away from the other side of the
Channel.
So
if we come to the Isle of Wight, it'll be only to visit you, Natasha.
Oh, well, it'll be a great pleasure, and we can feed you all the garlic you'd like.
I love garlic. Love garlic.
Pleased to hear that.
We need to explore this just a little bit. Before we came on the air, I mentioned to you that my mother died at age 96, believing, I think, that she had never ingested
garlic.
A piece of garlic, and probably never touched one either. Now, mm-hmm. both my wife and I cook with garlic, so she really did. She just didn't know. But it is not a common product in the United Kingdom, Brexit excluded. So how did it happen? Did you inherit something? What happened?
Well, my father, he bought, garlic to the, originally it was my grandparents. They started the farm, and my grandmother had started growing garlic in her kitchen garden, inspired by Elizabeth David's cookery. Garlic grew very well there, and then my parents joined the farm, and my dad was always wanted to do things very differently, and he'd been working in France, and he'd seen that garlic grew well in my grandmother's garden, so he decided to start a commercial crop of garlic, and that was back in the 1970s.
And my mother,
we've been growing garlic on the Isle of Wight since then.
Wow, amazing. And why does it grow so well there?
Well, the Isle of Wight has got slightly more temperate climate to the rest of the UK. We have more sunlight,
here, sunlight light intensity, slightly warmer temperatures, and there's a specific variety that we grow here quite a lot of that grows particularly well on the Isle of Wight.
Well, and do you export it to the UK or to all over Europe?
Well, we actually make all sorts of things with garlic. So we don't only grow garlic, but we also make about 60 different products all with garlic in them.
Like what?
So jars of chutney and relishes and sauces and garlic butter and garlic bread and garlic mayonnaise. And we sell those all over the UK, and we do export a small amount to Europe as well.
And are they under the label Mersley Farm or what?
No, that is the Garlic Farm, it's called.
What is the company name? What would be on the label?
The Garlic Farm. The Garlic Farm on the Isle of Wight.
It's on the label.
It's on the label. It says the Garlic Farm.
I'm surprised I haven't read. I do
things
on products.
You can see thegarlicfarm.co.uk, and it has all of our products. We have an e-commerce website, and we can send products all over the world. In fact, we have had customers from the U.S. We're sending products over there. So.
Oh, good. That's great. I'll have to check it out. You never do the fancy food show, though, in New York, do you? Because that's what the fancy food show. I do a big article on the new products every year, but I've never encountered yours.
Ah, well, we're still relatively small. We have not huge at the moment, but we're a very fast growing business. So we're definitely in the world of garlic. We're a big deal. Most garlic people involved in garlic know about us because we've been exploring garlic and different varieties of garlic and gathering all the different varieties of garlic and selling them to seed specialists who want to grow their own garlic. So,
my mother said you have to have a little bit of evil in you to grow garlic.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, is that an old wives' tale?
Well, I think that garlic has a lot of folklore attached to it, doesn't it? I think that's because people couldn't quite understand why this incredible plant was so good for you, and it almost seemed magical. And so people associated it with good luck, good fortune, good health. People would hang it in their doorways.
Scaring away vampires?
Exactly, to ward off evil spirits,
yes.
That kind of thing. But in actual fact, now it's being proven by science that garlic is incredibly good for your body. And it's not just an old wives' tale. It really is.
Oh, it is. Explain it. You talk about it in your book.
And that's not just because if you eat a lot of garlic, people will stay away from you. And as a result, you won't get communicable diseases.
Well, that could be one side effect. But actually, there's some chemical reaction that's going on with garlic when you crush it that makes this incredible thing called allicin. So inside a clove of garlic, you've got these two things, allin and allinase. And when you crush the garlic, you'll create the chemical reaction that makes allicin. And allicin is the thing that is very good for your health, but it also brings out the flavor in garlic. So you might have noticed when you smell a garlic bulb before you've actually crushed it or cut it, it doesn't smell. And then when you crush it, the more you crush it, the more you're creating the allicin and the more you're creating the flavor and the smell.
I have a question
really
for you.
And that's really good for you.
Do your fields smell of garlic as you drive across them?
Well, the actual fields don't smell, but the farm itself, we have a restaurant at the farm, a very, very popular restaurant where we make all sorts of garlicky food, and that definitely smells.
Oh, we have to go there.
We
have all sorts of amazing things on the menu.
It's kind of tricky to get to because you have to take a ferry to get there.
Yeah, I know.
You can't jump across. Now, what I was relating to is that one of our trips to Italy, we made many of them. We were in Puglia, which is in the southeast part of Italy, in the heel, and the northern part of Puglia is a great garlic growing region. And as you drive through the fields, you really can smell the reek of garlic.
You don't say reek, it means the aroma.
The aroma. I couldn't think of the right word. Aroma, of course,
smell
is correct.
You have some good tips in here for buying good garlic. and storing it. I've never had luck with storing garlic. I mean, I end up putting it in the refrigerator, then, of course, it sprouts or gets moldy or whatever. But I use it up pretty quickly. But I don't. Everyone says you leave it at room temperature with good ventilation, and they
that's
have these
right.
pots that
yeah,
never
right.
worked for me. They didn't work at all with the holes in them, you know. And you have a picture of one in here.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, actually, if you can buy garlic already plaited, you know, in the strings, that's a really good way to store it so that you can hang it up in your kitchen. It looks really beautiful.
Oh, yes.
You can just break off a bulb whenever you want one. And in that way, that it has lots of air circulating around it, it's definitely the best way of storing it.
But
definitely don't put it in the fridge, because garlic will then think it's time to sprout, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely don't seal it as well, because it starts to sweat and then it goes moldy.
Okay.
Ooh, well,
I'm going to have to switch.
Yeah.
I've tried all this
money we've been wasting on garlic.
we
got these green shoots now. The good news is you don't have to throw the green shoots away, right?
That's right. You really don't.
Although, can still use them.
That's right, and you can actually grow your own green shoots and then snip them off and, you know, use them as a garnish. They're like garlicky flavored spring onions, or what do you call them? Something different, not spring onions.
Scallions?
I can't remember.
Scallions.
Yeah, exactly.
You can
grow your own on the windowsill. But some people remove the green shoot inside because they find it gives them indigestion, but it's actually very good for you as well if you can tolerate it.
I thought it made the garlic bitter, is what I thought.
Yeah, as well. It's edible, though. It's something you can eat.
Now, in the springtime, here in the part of the United States where we live, and in the adjacent state of West Virginia in particular, is the season for what are called ramps. And ramps are wild garlic.
Yes, we have a lot of that.
You have ramps in the Isle of Wight?
We do indeed, yeah. We have a lot that grows in areas where you would find bluebells, are usually places where you'll find wild garlic. And it's a beautiful thing to cook with. We can make wild garlic pesto or mix it into salads,
use it
in soups.
What about scapes?
And scapes, one of my favorite products, byproducts of garlic. So we grow a lot of elephant garlic here. And elephant garlic is one of the varieties that throws up a flowering head. So it's the shoot of the garlic as it appears. We cut that off to maximize the size of the bulb. And that's called the scape.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yes, and you can cook with that. And it makes the most amazing addition to stir fries, soups.
Yeah, all the farmers' markets load up on those in the spring.
I think that across the water there, you have much more embraced scapes earlier than the UK has. But I'm shouting about scapes over here because they're the most wonderful, delicious thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, your recipes are very good now.
Yeah, let's talk about the book here. There is a book included in this conversation.
They're not all your recipes that you've made up new. I mean, I giggled when I saw this 40 cloves of garlic chicken. I remember that from the 70s.
Exactly. That's a real 70s dish, isn't it?
Yes.
it's
one of my favorites. It's so
Doesn't Lydia Bastianich have one with 100?
Let's go that step further.
And I think it also calls for two full bottles of red wine.
Oh, very good.
Sounds like covering all the toast points, right?
Here it is, and you don't peel them for the 40 cloves of garlic, and it's really, it sounds awful, but it's very mild, isn't it?
Well, the thing is that if you don't crush the garlic, then you're not making allicin, which is what's responsible for that really strong heat flavor of garlic. So actually, you're bringing out all of the sweetness in the cloves. And when they're cooked in this way, then it completely caramelizes them inside, and then you can just squeeze out the flesh, and you can make it into a creamy sauce or gravy to go with it.
Now, who is responsible for these recipes? I mean, I'm looking at this warm lentil and halloumi salad with pomegranate seeds in it, and it's gorgeous.
Well, over the years, we've done a lot of experimenting with garlic. We've accumulated recipes from all sorts of inspirations, and having our own restaurant as well, we've tried and tested all sorts of things, and some things, you know, are experimental, and some things work, and some things don't, but this was a way of putting together all of this, the ways of cooking with garlic that we think brings out the different flavors, the health benefits, and really gives you the variety, because there's dishes from all over the world.
Yeah, you have Thailand, you have Som Tam.
It's Som Tam, my favorite. I used to live in Bangkok for a short while.
Oh, so I wondered if you had a connection there. Okay. I said, I wondered, I thought you might have a connection there.
Yes, I lived in just near Silom Road, and there was one of those outdoor markets. And every day, you could go there for lunch, and there was a guy with what looked like an enormous pestle and mortar, and he would make a fresh pot Som Tam salad in there, and he would throw lots and lots of chili in. It was very hot. It was absolutely delicious.
Yeah, well, you must like spicy, because you also have spicy sprouting broccoli.
That's right.
Well,
chili and garlic go well together.
I'll have to try the 40 cloves of garlic in the beer can chicken.
Oh, yes, put those together.
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Oh, I made that. I made it in the 70s.
You mean you didn't make the beer can version?
No, I didn't, no. I'm going to try this avocado garlic shrimp. I mean, garlic and shrimp go together, too.
They do. It's a great combination. It really brings, I think, the sweetness of the shrimp and the garlic together go really well.
Well, you sound like you cook a little bit.
Yes, when I get time.
So, and here's one that has to go on our menu for this winter, immunity-boosting soup, which looks like It has everything you need in it. You got your umami from the shiitake mushrooms.
Exactly.
Is that the one that's got the small pieces of kitchen sink chopped up in it?
Shiitake, porcini, oyster.
In fact, you can use any mushrooms, but the mixture of mushrooms there is just to give some variety in the flavors. But the shiitake ones are meant to be very good for your health, particularly.
Yeah. Well, you know what we should throw in here, because we have ginger in here, but we've been playing around with fresh turmeric root. And that's another health thing.
It's high, you're right.
And it lowers blood pressure, and it boosts the immune system and all kinds of things. So, boy, that's it.
And it turns all your food orange.
It turns everything orange.
And your utensils.
And your utensils. And you talk about garlic fingers. There's also turmeric fingers.
That's right.
Well, Natasha, this is a delightful book.
Thank you.
Yeah, and
what a great discovery.
Yes, we want to come visit you, for sure. I would have laughed.
I would have laughed myself silly if somebody told me they grew garlic on the Isle of Wight.
Well, I know, it is a bit of a surprise, but you should definitely come and visit us. We've got a restaurant, a lovely shop. We have tastings of all of our products. You can come and taste everything before you buy, and then we're in a beautiful location overlooking the valley, and we've opened up all of the farmland for anybody to come, and they can walk around and learn all about the different garlic varieties. We've even got garlic bread making workshops. So that sounds like perfectly
up our alley. Do you have rooms for overnight?
So yes, we have 7 holiday cottages.
Uh-huh.
So you can come and book to stay as well.
Oh, good. Well, this is a revelation. Peter's itching to get there. So I think we'll probably meet Natasha Edwards.
You should go to the Isle of Wight at least once every 60 years.
Definitely.
Whether you need to or not.
We'll do another visit.
I think so. Well, thank you so much for sharing this really wonderful information that the Brexit may not work, but if you increase the quantity of garlic,
there's hope for us yet.
Yeah, there's new hope for Britain.
Garlic is the answer.
Yes. Alrighty. Well, thank you again, Natasha, and look forward
to
meeting you in
much.
Person.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Bye bye.
And that's a wrap for today's program. You know where we'll be, same time, same place next week. We hope you'll be in the same place too. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.